tonight, I believe. All right, so here's the mic, Ken.
Well, thank you, Lynn. And yes, I am here with Daniel in his studio.
Hello.
And what he is asked to do is to sing a song to start off. So you are going to get, this is my last song, If This Is My Last Song, live by Daniel Namad. Take it away, Daniel.
If this is my last song, if this is my final day, if tomorrow I'll be gone, what do I want to say? If this is my last song, if it's my time to go, when my body's moved on, what will I have to show? Oh, but fortune and fame, they scatter to the wind the things that make a name, just don't matter in the end. But is the world a little more peaceful? Oceans and skies a little more blue? Is humankind a little bit wiser about the good that we can do? Does the sun shine a little bit brighter where before there was only rain? If so, then I'm glad I came. These are my last words for all of the earth to hear. If all that I have ever been is about to disappear, if these are my last words, there's nothing that I need to say. I have only tried to serve. It's never been about talking anyway. So much hurt there is to heal. It's hard to understand. All I can hope to feel is that I am doing what I can. Is the world a little more peaceful? Oceans and skies a little more blue? Is humankind a little bit wiser about the good that we can do? Does the sun shine a little bit brighter where before there was only rain? If so, then I'm glad I came. Have I given hope to the hopeless? Has a hungry soul been fed? Has a child stood a little bit taller because of something that I said? Have I left a little kindness? Have I eased a little pain? If so, then I'm glad I came. For that, I'm so glad I came. If this is my last song, what do I leave behind? What do I pass on if I am out of time?
Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.
Now, I would say that probably I'm the only person here that knows you beyond the last month when Regina and I started playing some of your songs. Mm-hmm. So if you could fill people in on a brief or lengthy, whichever you prefer,
history of
how you got into this.
Let's see. There's a line in last song that always makes me internally chuckle, which is, it's never been about talking anyway.
Yes.
And that is sometimes I'll start singing that song after having given the song like an 8-minute introduction and realize what a hypocrite I'm being. I'll give a brief summary of who everyone is listening to. Let's see. So my name is Daniel Namot. It's nice to be singing and talking with you today, everybody out there in the universe. And thank you for inviting me to do this.
You're very welcome.
And welcome to my little recording studio here in Orange County, California. I have been making music for a living for the last, we're now at 16 years. Before that, I was pretending to be a computer programmer for half a dozen years at a series of good, profitable companies, sitting at a desk. And as I realized all of a sudden, one day, selling my days for money. It was December 4th, 1997, that I realized that I was in the wrong place doing the wrong thing. I was in a dream job in somebody else's dream.
Yes.
That I sort of realized. And walked away from it. Most painful day of my life. I had to leave the girl I was engaged to be married to. Left a career that was on a pretty good track, left the city I'd grown up in, Chicago, and moved across the country to LA to make music. And as I have, I've learned along the way that it was very unlikely to make a living making music in LA as a singer-songwriter, and I am not at all joking when I say I'm glad I didn't know how unlikely it would be.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yes, yes. So I dove in, you know, in the proverbial, I sank the ships that took me to the new world. I had no fallback plan.
Right.
I came to LA, I rented a little apartment in West Hollywood, and I started making records. So since then I've made 15 albums. I've been sung thousands of times now for all sorts of things. My first ever gig was at a flower shop in Hollywood.
And Humble beginnings.
They gave me four $20 bills to sing. Basically, I sang mostly Beatles songs for a 3-hour flower happy hour that they had in their shop, where all the flowers were half price, and they had live music, which was me for a couple months. And what I discovered is that I'm a songwriter, and I discovered that there are. See, I'm a songwriter who doesn't feel too much rage or too much misery.
Good.
I write rage and misery songs every so often. I kind of dabble in them, but they're never true songs. They're actually sort of me acting in a certain way. And I have sarcastic songs and goofy songs and codependent songs and miserable songs. I do. And I'm not saying I'm immune to those moods. But when I write songs, generally, and I've written a couple thousand songs, and most of them are terrible, but, you know, I've written a couple thousand songs, and almost all of them are about some sort of connection, compassion, healing, forgiveness. It's almost a burden. I'm being serious. It's actually, something in me inherently wants a song to be about something that something in me considers meaningful, if that makes sense.
Yes.
That is to say, saying something other than what you hear everybody saying about the romance that ended, the romance that's beginning, the romance that never should have begun, the romance that never should have ended, and round and round and round you go, you know, the drink you should have had, the drink you shouldn't have had, and so on. So,
Your typical commercial
song. Typical commercial song, which I'm all for commercial. I have no judgment about it. In fact, I have the opposite of no judgment. I admire gifted people in the field, and, you know, and so anyway, that is to say. So what I found moving to L.A., and I gradually found it, really, is that there are communities all over the United States who were all in when somebody showed up singing not just positive songs, but my kind of song, you know, like a song like Last Song that you just heard, where I'm asking myself some pretty heavy questions, you know, about why I'm here, what good work really means, what a legacy really means.
Right.
And I found communities all over the country who received me with spectacular generosity and kindness and warmth and love and enthusiasm. So 15 years on, I've sung for a lot of people. I've sold a fair number of records for somebody who flies entirely under the radar of that traditional music industry. I'd like to think that the song Last Song does fit the work I've done. My drop of water in the ocean is a clear drop, you know, is a contributing drop of water. Really, I really want that. I also want to make enough money to pay for my kid, you know, to go to Harvard and so on. I'm there. I live on Earth, you know, also. But musically, there's something I'm attempting to do or intending to do that compels me at all times. It's a question I wish I could stop asking me: is does this contribute? Does this do good? Does this have a point? Is there a message? Is this meaningful? Will this move people? Rather than, quote-unquote, just entertaining, even though I'm the first person to sit on a couch and watch Adam Sandler movies, you know, and eat bonbons. Yeah. That's me. But my musical work has been about trying to do good. And it's not even for me to say whether I have done any good, but it feels like I have. That is to say, it feels like I haven't left victims in my wake over 15 years. I've done good work with good intentions, with clear conscience, with kindness, always seeking win-win-win situations. And so here I sit today, 15 years later, and so that's the answer.
Well, based on my talk this morning, you have affected me.
Well, thank you.
Water, the CD.
Yeah.
The experience.
Yeah.
The sabbatical.
Yeah.
The retreats.
Yeah.
If you can give us a little background into that, because that's when we met you, is when you were doing, I think you had just introduced the Water CD, you were doing the Water retreats up in Moab. So if you can basically give us the... talk about that.
When I was computer programming, I was eating and stressing and suppressing myself to death.
Yes.
And I had a discontent that didn't match my circumstances. My circumstances were I had a lovely fiance, a lovely job, no debt, a lovely apartment, a career on track, etc. Right. So that was a discontent that I felt that did not match my life, at least my external earthly life. It just didn't match. It didn't make sense that I wasn't happy. It looked like the life of a happy person.
Right.
Okay. So
all the trappings, all the appearances.
So I couldn't talk myself out that I was living the wrong life. I was lying for a living. So fast forward 7 years, and I felt discontent again. That was after I'd already made 4, 5, 6 records, and I was singing every, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week, volunteering at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in L.A. I was doing all kinds of things that would appear to make somebody fulfilled, and there was the discontent again. And this time, I was no idiot. I'm not going to spend a year or 5 or whatever it would be talking myself out of a discontent. So in other words, I felt something ending. And I truly didn't know what it was. And in order to hear what it was, I needed to leave Los Angeles. If you've ever been to Los Angeles, you know that there are no quiet places in Los Angeles. Basically, except in, you know, bathrooms with the doors closed, maybe in an abandoned building. You'd get quiet in Los Angeles. So what I did is I drove across the country. So I moved out of my apartment in West Hollywood. I handed the keys of my business to an assistant. I said, I'm going to be gone for 3 months. It was, everything about it was arbitrary. It was seemingly random. I'm going to be leaving. Please ship orders that I receive over the next 3 months. I told basically no one where I was going except my family. And I went and I rented a little house in a place that I had vaguely remembered was lovely. And I knew it was a small town and was in nature and was in a place that's packed in the summer but empty in the winter. And that would be Moab, Utah. It's a place I had driven through on my way moving from Chicago to Los Angeles to make a living making music. So back I drove to Moab, camped out in this house that I had rented sight unseen over the phone. And for 3 months, got as quiet. You can already tell I'm a talker, right? I got as quiet as I've ever been. There was no one to talk to. The town of 5,000 in the summer was down to 1,000 in the winter. Most of Main Street was closed. The national parks, Arches, Canyonlands, several state parks, abandoned in the winter. Nobody there for hours and days. Not even the park rangers were working some of the times I was in the park. Nobody at all. No, the gates just open and just come on in. So I hiked all over those Red Rock canyons and cliffs and arches and frozen streams and laid out in the main road in Arches National Park in the middle of the night and looked up at the stars. The main road. They get 1 million visitors a year. And I saw no one, heard nothing. I mean nothing. No sound. No sound at all. No wind, no planes, no birds. I heard an owl one time in the park in the middle of the night. But so it was cold, but not that cold because I'm from Chicago. I can handle it.
Yeah, cold is relative.
Cold is relative. And I wrote 125 songs. So the second day that I got to Moab, a song came to me. And as I have said to audiences over the years, imagine you're an artist, which everybody is. Imagine you're an artist and you've run out of excuses for why you can't create something today. And that was my situation. I am very good at doing something else when I get a song idea, and I get song ideas every day. It's a faucet that I force off. You know what I mean? Like I force it to not flood me because I'd rather do anything than delve into my unconscious. Very inconvenient. It takes time. It takes emotion. It's draining. It's naked. It's vulnerable. It's a lot of things. But in Moab, I had no excuses. So the floodgates opened. And by the third or fourth day, I was writing 3 or 4 or 5 songs a day. And like I said, 125. I wrote song number 126 on the afternoon when my car was packed up to leave Moab at the end of the third month. And looking back on that music, after I'd come back to what actually felt like the seventh circle of hell, was Los Angeles, after such an experience, although Santa Monica wasn't bad. That's where I landed. Santa Monica is no seventh circle of hell. If you've ever been there, it's basically paradise. But in contrast to the quiet,
yes,
you know, and the solitude. And I wasn't alone. I wasn't a hermit. There was a grocery store. There was a chocolate frozen yogurt store. There was even a movie theater. I think I went to one movie. I had no TV. I had no phone in this house. There was internet, but dial-up, which I never used. All I did was write songs, hike, make myself dinner. It was spectacular. It was the kind of experience now, especially, I have a 3-year-old son and a wife and a dog. None of whom I had met when I was in Moab. I had none of those obligations. I mean, hear me, I love them more than life itself.
Yes,
that's the truth.
I know that.
But I had nothing tying me to anywhere. And instead, I floated in this sort of half on earth, half not place. And obviously, you've heard the water songs. Actually, everybody who's listening just heard one of them. That was song number 100, the song Last Song. Was one of the most profound writing experiences I've ever had because I was, what I was doing when I started writing that song was I was actually picking up trash alongside the Colorado River just outside of Moab. because it was there was trash there, and because it's the most beautiful place in the universe, and I was so upset that people dropped McDonald's bags and beer cans on the side of the Colorado River with red cliffs rising. But the upset left me very quickly as I started picking up the trash, and I started getting into it and loving it. And for hours, I picked up trash along just about a mile stretch. Well, this is a 25-mile road, this stretch of the road. They call it the River Road, and it runs along the river for a while and alongside some of the most beautiful scenery you'll ever see in your life. And but as I was picking up maybe a mile of this road, I started asking myself, am I making any difference at all? I mean, the trash goes on forever. It'll just be back here next year. You know, I won't be here to pick it up. And then it occurred to me, well, I'm doing it. And it actually may be all I can do. And if it's all I can do, could I possibly let go of the idea that I have to do everything and allow what I can do to be enough? Right?
Yes.
And that's a real stretch for somebody who wants to make $1 million, who wants to win a Nobel Prize, who wants to whatever ambition you've got. Imagine what you've done is enough already.
Yes.
That's a stretch. That's a very difficult thing for an ego to accept. And so these water songs, a bunch of the songs, probably 15 or 20 of them, maybe several you've never heard because I, you know, culled them to 11 for that water CD. But those songs are all about asking the question, do I need to pretend that I am in as much control as I think I am? Do I need to take as much credit when things go right, quote unquote? Do I need to take as much blame when things go wrong, quote unquote? Will I be remembered? How do I know? Why do I care? How can I possibly claim to control my legacy when I won't be there, right?
Yes.
What is ever permanent? And the answer is nothing is permanent. And so the water songs all revolve around not giving up, but surrendering the attachment. And I could tell just from listening to 15 minutes of the program that was on just before us,
right,
that
Regina.
This is a subject that comes up quite a bit.
Oh, yes.
About attachment. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's ever really about me. You know, there are a lot of, anyway, so I've been talking continuously.
That's what this is about. Okay. They want to hear about you, not me.
So that's what the water songs are. And that experience, needless to say, changed me.
Yes.
It's the reason I met my wife. It's the reason I'm sitting in the studio today. It's because, as one of the songs is called, I go where the ocean says to go. I really do. I'm not a master of it. You'll hear me say that on stage at any performance. I would be lying if I told anybody that I have figured this out. That is to say, that I don't still have the pride and the ego, that I still don't want a Grammy nomination, that I still don't want $1 million. I'm not going to pretend I don't. But a part of me turned off in Moab, and a different part of me turned on in Moab. And the part that turned on in Moab will never turn off again. And that part is the part that trusts and cannot possibly, I mean, I cannot possibly take credit or blame for my son's personality. I cannot possibly do it. He's three. Whether he's 3 or 30 or 93, he is already a full-blown, feisty little person with his own opinions and tastes. And how crazy would I make myself by owning everything he does and says and is? It would be insane. That the same thing applies to a business I grow or don't grow or start or finish, or a relationship that starts or finishes, or I try to make the world a more peaceful place and lo and behold, when I die, it isn't. Did I fail or did I do what I could do with what I had and let the outcome be the outcome? You know, water being the master teacher of that.
Yes.
You know, water pouring down a river, wearing away a coast when it's time, pooling when it's time, freezing when it's time, evaporating when it's time, falling as rain or snow, getting locked in a glacier, you know, getting caught in the joke I crack is that every molecule of water probably over time, the molecule of water in the saliva in your mouth, once launched out of Old Faithful geyser in Yellowstone, right?
Yes.
Which I like to think is one of the most glorious uses of water in the world. Now, one of my favorite places is Yellowstone National Park. So that water, man, that was a rock star that day, the day it came out of Old Faithful. That's a spectacular day for a drop of water. I mean, it's a good day.
Yeah.
That's a cool thing to do. But then fast forward 100 years, and then and that same drop of water is in a muddy puddle in a factory somewhere, outside a factory, in a parking lot. And it's the same drop of water. And do you hear that water complaining, or does it just go about its business? It doesn't drop in that puddle and say, excuse me, I used to be, right? I was supposed to be. No, you don't understand. I carved the Grand Canyon. I'm not supposed to be in this puddle, right? So all these thoughts occur to me in Moab, because Moab is carved by water.
Yes.
Over billions of years, multiple oceans have risen and fallen there, and the place itself is constantly changing. In fact, one of the cutest things about Arches National Park to me, after these 3 months of, you know, sort of pondering, was that they give you a map when you come into the park of where the arches are, as if the arches will be there tomorrow. And of course, by their very nature, I mean, you look at an arch today, it is different than the arch was there yesterday. Infinitesimally so, most of the time. Every so often there's a
crash.
Right. But most of the time it's a few flakes of red dirt that are gone. And you're walking on trails in Arches National Park on red dirt. It isn't red dirt. It's former arches that you're walking on. You know? So all these thoughts, you know, circled around my brain and my soul, really, for those 3 months, and came out as the songs that you've heard on the Water CD. And for a few years after then, I hosted retreats back in Moab. I took groups back there. We stayed in a nice hotel, because I do not do camping, because it just sounds really uncomfortable. I only tried it once, and I have never slept less in my life. Actually, that's not true. Until my son was born. Since my son's born, I sleep less all the time. But at the time, it was devastating. So I took groups back to Moab. And we hiked in the Slot Canyons, and we walked in the national parks. I took them back in the winter so they could feel the quiet, and sang the songs and read from the Tao, which I saw you have somebody reading from your Tao in a recent program.
Yes, we've studied. I'm in the ministerial preparation program.
Oh, are you? Okay.
To become an ordained minister.
Uh-huh.
And one of the books that we studied was the Tao.
The Tao. Did I read from the Tao that day when we met in Tustin?
I don't remember.
Okay. So I found the Tao in the Moab Public Library, which was the size of this room. And this is not a big room.
Right.
Now, since then, it's bigger. They've expanded it. But it was a tiny room, and I was just leafing through things. And as I say, I go where the ocean says to go. I just walked into this library and was just curious what I'd find in such a tiny little town library. And there was a book, the Tao, that I'd heard of and had never read. Brought it back to, you know, rented it, took it out. Brought it back to the house, started flipping through it, and realized that 5,000 years ago or so, 4,000 years ago, whatever, what I was writing in song had already been written in this book. And if you were, not suggesting it, but if you were to sit and read the Tao and listen to water, you would hear exactly the same ideas. I'll tell you straight up, the Water CD is, every song is about the same thing. Right? There's different feelings to the songs. Some are chipper, some are, you know, quiet, but they're all about the same thing. They're all about going where the ocean says to go.
Well, if you went reading the Tao, every chapter, verse in there is about the same thing.
It's about the same thing. That's right. About not fighting, not straining, not needing.
Yes, just being.
Just being. And letting that be enough. And being aware that that is how the Grand Canyon was carved. That it's not giving up doing anything. It's having an entirely different feeling about what you're doing. It's, instead of it being stress and pride and anxiety and fear and pressure and achievement and awards or recognition or blame, it's about being who you were born to be, doing what makes you happiest, being of service, and then allowing your body to return to the earth like the arches drop down into red sand.
Right, they dust to dust.
Dust to dust, and just becoming, and just realizing all along that you are a drop of water on the river going through the Grand Canyon. You will be in the puddle, you will be in the glacier, and you will come out of Old Faithful one day. You know?
Yes.
And all in good time, and it's very difficult. Like I said, I have not mastered this at all, nor do I think anyone has ever mastered it. To be honest, I don't think there would be really such a thing. I'm not sure there's such a thing as a master. In my experience, scratch the surface of everybody teaching something brilliant, and you find a human being.
Yes.
Which is as it ought to be, but it's easy to forget because it seems so lordly and profound to hear somebody say something profound that rocks your world or changes your life, but they're still a person. And so I don't think anyone could master this. You know, somebody who teaches the water ideas, who has a child, is probably not entirely detached from their child. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, they take sides with their child. The Dalai Lama, brilliant, beautiful, lovely man, takes sides with Tibet. He cares. He cares about Tibet. You know, Jesus walks into the temple and sees moneylenders there. He didn't say, "It's all good, baby." He got mad.
Yes.
Right? He had a feeling about it. You know, these are people. So, like I said, I'm not comparing myself to any of those people anyway, but I have not mastered this level of surrender and trust. But I do find that even dabbling in it and experimenting with it transforms an entire idea or process into a much more natural and organic and, dare I say, productive activity. You know, sleeping better, thinking clearer, laughing louder.
More joy.
Oh, just way more. When it's not about how it turns out, not about how it looks, not about how it'll be remembered or forgotten, not about whether I'll get credit or blame. It's a very different experience of doing anything. Parenting, husbanding, producing records, writing songs, giving gigs. I'm a completely different person than I was even performing before I went to Moab. Very different. So, there you go.
So, at this point, it kind of sounds like when you had this transformational, that your spiritual side of you was much different, if at all, prior to this. And then you have this profound awakening. When I listen to the words and the music in here, I hear influences of the Tao, of Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
of every major religion. I could sit there and pull out all the ones that we've studied.
I've been told that, yeah.
That I can say, yep, that's from the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah. I have an Indian friend who says that planting seeds is straight out of the Gita.
Yeah. It's some of the talks that Krishna had with Arjuna over be happy with who you are. Live your life. Follow your path. Don't worry about the shoulds and the coulds and the would-haves and have-tos. Just be who you are. So I remember people asking you in some of the services I've been to, what is your spiritual influence? And you, if I remember right, there isn't one specific.
No, I kind of have none, to be honest. Well, I mean, I'm Jewish. I grew up in going to synagogue every Saturday, staying home every Friday night. It's pretty close to an Orthodox family. Orthodox enough that my older brother is an Orthodox rabbi.
Uh-huh.
I have always been more interested in whether a person was nice than observant,
yes.
Which is not a popular position to take in a traditional religion. You can be nice, but you must be observant of the rules. Mm-hmm. And I just never, I never really cared about the rule. I know the rules inside and out, the Jewish Judaism rules. I know them. They're in my DNA, literally. And I've got them. I know, I speak Hebrew. I know when I'm not practicing a holiday. You know, I know when I'm not doing what I was raised to do. I know. But I also, am much more interested in kindness and, happiness. If you're not nice to animals, then I don't care if you pray properly. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's always been more interesting to me. So, and growing up with that feeling about the Jewish rules, and there are many, many, many rules in Judaism for Hiv, that translated very directly to, as I learned about other religions, I realized that every religion has kind of just as many rules, and I still didn't care about them. I actually only care if you're nice.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds simplistic. Kind and nice, to me is more, is really, and it makes me a, it's always made me a sucker, you know, because I'm not always a good gauge of whether someone really is nice or whether they're being nice or whether, and I'm not saying I'm always nice, not even close, but let's say the majority of time I am. And so sometimes people will act nice because you've acted nice, but that doesn't make them nice. So I don't know if this sounds like a digression, but it's a tricky thing. And people who appear pious can appear nice or kind. But, you know, maybe Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, how you act, speak so loudly, I can't hear what you say.
Yes.
And that has always been true for me. So religious background for the song One Power that you apparently played this morning. Religious background for the water stuff. I have never read the Bhagavad Gita. I've never studied Buddhism. You know, very, very simple understanding of Christianity. It's just not in my head. I don't know Islam. I know a little bit about Baha'i because I grew up near the Baha'i Temple in suburbs of Chicago, so I was there every so often. I love that place, which is why I refer to Baha'u'llah in the One Power song. Mm-hmm. So no, there's really no, it's just me making it up for myself. Which, well, we kind of all do, let's face it.
Yes, but kindness, your kindness is really all that matters.
To me.
Well, for us, for me.
For you too.
Is,
yeah.
I can only control me. I am only responsible for me.
Yeah.
And if I am as kind, if I am as loving as I can be in the moment, then I'm glad I came.
Then that's all you can do. That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little frustrating, isn't it?
I used to ride the train going into work with a Muslim and a Catholic, and I was raised Christian light. We never read Revelations.
Christian light. Okay, got it, yeah.
And one of the things that came in our talking about our religions was, there's different books, there's different ceremonies, there are different practices, but the one thing that was common was love.
Mm-hmm.
That the core of all of these major religious beliefs was for everybody to be a little kinder,
mm-hmm.
a little more loving.
Mm-hmm.
And when that realization came to me, then it really said, it doesn't matter
mm-hmm.
what title you want to put on something or someone. It's, are they loving? Are they kind? It's all that matters. And especially me.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, the Pope is in the Philippines, I believe, and they've had a major typhoon, and a lot of people lost their lives and lost their belongings. And the quote that I read that he spoke to, a large crowd gathered to hear him speak, even though I think it was pouring rain. And he said, I'm going to paraphrase badly, but he said, many of you have lost more than I can imagine losing. There is nothing I can say to you, but there is a lot that God can say to you. So I'm going to sit here silently and just be with you. That to me is kindness. To not come across as a saint, as a lecturer, as, you know what I'm saying? That just
felt
compassionate and aware that the individual human beings in front of him were going through something and talking to it with great kindness, you know.
Well, Rebecca,
without platitudes, exactly right.
Right. Rebecca calls it holding space.
Holding space, yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, rather than coming right at them with something. A pre-written speech. He apparently threw out his pre-written speech, said a prayer for them spontaneously on the spot, and sat with them. Yeah.
Yes. Well, before we go on, is there another song you would like to play for the group here?
Well,
or do we keep going?
Whatever you prefer. Whatever you prefer. What would you like?
Want to do water?
Sure, I can sing water for you. I just happen to have my guitar here.
Well, we are in your studio.
The fix was in. Yeah, we're in my studio. If I didn't have my guitar here, something is strange. There we go. This is the song. And I do remember writing this, and I was sitting in the back of a slot canyon, sitting on a giant boulder with my baby Taylor guitar, a little travel guitar, slung over my shoulder. And the Tao. And I sat down on this boulder and listened to a trickle of snowmelt drop down into the canyon into a pool that was frozen in front of me. The water was trickling slowly out of the slot canyon, and I sat there for 3 or 4 hours in complete and total silence. And I had my voice recorder with me, which is how I write songs. I took out my little baby guitar after reading the Tao and my voice recorder and wrote this song in that spot in Utah, in Moab. Outside of my head. I've seen my share of struggle when I thought that I knew best. When I've sailed through a storm instead of stopping to rest. But it always seems the hardest when I've made up my stubborn mind. Well, I'm changing my ways this time. Wanna be like water coming down a mountain into shadowy canyons, flowing from pool to stream. Wanna be like water, head uphill no more. I am bound for the sea. Have you ever seen an eagle? Head straight into the wind. He doesn't pick a fight, spreads his wings and just gives in. And in the end he always makes it home just fine. Guess he knows that every storm subsides. Wanna be like water coming down the mountain into shadowy canyons, flowing from pool to stream. Wanna be like water, head uphill no more. I am bound for the sea. I'll let nature take its course. No more thinking that I know where this river's meant to go. I have railed against the stars for the cards that I've been dealt, for the lottery I've never won, for the heartache that I've felt. But it always seems when I let go of expectation and regret, life has plenty of surprises for me yet. Wanna be like water coming down a mountain into shadowy canyons, flowing from pool to stream. Wanna be like water, head uphill no more. I am bound for the sea. Wanna be like water coming down a mountain into shadowy canyons, flowing from pool to stream. Wanna be like water,
head uphill no more I am bound for the sea.
If you listen to the Water CD, like you obviously have,
yes,
you'll hear that I am quiet. You know, even there's only one or two places on that whole album I raise my voice at any level. And that's because I was only back a few months from Moab, and I wasn't really back. You know what I mean? I mean, I was not back.
Yeah.
I was still in that quiet place, and so these songs are whispered, most of them. Last song, very barely sung, you know. Anyway, and it reminds me, I'm reminded of it, but I'm not quite there anymore because my life has changed so much, because I feel a different level of, like I said, attachment to wife, baby, house, dog, attachment that I welcome, that I actually am proud of, but it isn't consistent. It isn't consistent with the purest interpretation of these songs. It just isn't.
Right.
So I'm in the middle again, which is, I think, where I ought to be, at least certainly now. In other words, I can't judge it. It's just fine. But I'm aware of it. I'm aware that, no, I actually really care that my son is okay right now, at this moment. It matters to me. In other words, I'm not detached from all earthly stuff.
Right.
His little butt, no, I'm attached to how how cute it is, and his little cheeks, and, you know, and his perfect little hand. I mean, he is awesome, you know. So, no, I love him and my wife with an attachment. You know, I do. And I think that's actually probably not just a human thing. I'd be worried about myself if I didn't.
Yes. Know?
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I'm very attached to Rebecca.
Right. Even though I imagine you probably, regardless of the songs, you probably also go where the ocean says to go quite a bit. It's how you approached me, actually, about
this.
Yes,
that night at that concert.
Yeah.
There was no plan.
Yeah.
It was just, I call it the giant hand of God, just comes and pushes me
to do something
to the front of the room and says, this is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
And that's what we're talking about, right?
Yep. Is following guidance, intuition, whatever term you say, without the pride,
without needing anything about it. That's, right. You know, that's the scary thing is to, right. Yeah.
You have told stories about wandering the halls in the hospitals.
Yeah.
And you sang a song. You said you went into this one room and sang a song, and it happened to be a special song.
Yeah.
So you want to tell that quick one? And then Katrina, when you were down in the, what was it, Superdome?
Astrodome. I don't do as much of the volunteer work anymore. I don't want to say anymore. It sounds like it's over. This is not a stretch of time with my 3-year-old son. This is not a stretch of time where I'm giving away a lot of my time outside of my family. That's just a fact.
Right.
But when I first got to LA, and I had a lot of time on my hands, and I've always enjoyed singing. It's just how I was built. I'm not trying to sound like a saintly guy. I'm not a saint, not even by any stretch. But I have always enjoyed singing to make a room full of people or even one person happy. Always enjoyed it. I used to sing for my bubby in the hospital. I used to sing for everybody on her floor at her hospital long before I made a living making music. It was just something I always have enjoyed doing. So I went to donate blood one day at Cedars-Sinai, and I just spontaneously walked into the volunteer office and said, would you like somebody to walk the halls and play guitar and sing songs for people? And they said, we were just talking about that last week, how awesome it would be, and we didn't know who to ask, and that's perfect. Start next week. So they gave me training and the security clearance, and then they gave me this white outfit that made me look like a marshmallow. I probably said that night because I always felt like a marshmallow walking down the hall. I was just all in white, a little bit of a belly, you know, just my guitar against my white body, you know. I sang for about 2 years. I volunteered the way somebody can volunteer when they don't have a wife, a child, or a full-time job. I only did it once a week, but I always did it. I mean, I don't know if I ever canceled in those couple of years. And so I would walk the halls, sing for doctors, sing for nurses, sing for janitors, and of course sing for patients, which meant knocking on the door and just asking, would you like to hear a song? And it was just that simple. And as I talked about that night,
yes,
it was always an exercise. You know, even before I went to Moab, I have a song called I Don't Need to Know, which I won't sing today, but, you know, I don't need to know because God knows. So the notion of detaching from outcomes and from the illusion of being certain about something, which we only pretend we're sure how something will turn out, that notion did not start with the water songs. You know, it got amplified, but I had already been thinking. And when I would sing at Cedar Sinai, it was an ongoing practice of not taking anything personally. I sang a song if they said yes, and I didn't if they said no, and it was never about me. So that was just that story I told was about a woman who I walked in, and she said, sure, if you want to sing a song, I guess, an older lady. Barely awake and certainly not smiling, and I started singing. I just off the top of my head sang Stardust, and she started singing along within seconds, and sang along the rest of the song. And then when I finished, she said, as you've heard the story already, but she had said, "Why did you pick that song?" And I said, "I just plucked it. I don't know. I just thought of it. I love that song." And she said, she said, my husband and I were married, I'm pretty sure it was 50 years. When we got married, we danced to that song at our wedding, to Nat King Cole recording of that song at our wedding. And every year on our anniversary, we listened to Nat King Cole singing Stardust. And he's been gone 5 years, and every year on our anniversary, I go to his grave, and I open the car door, and I play Nat King Cole singing Stardust, and I sing it to him at his grave. And, you know, those are the kind of moments, when I would do the water retreats, I would ask the room full of people, one of my favorite tricks to play was to say, think of the three of the best things in your life. Define best any way you want. Life any way you want. Define every word in that sentence any way you want. But think of the three best things, or three of the best things in your life. And it usually came down to a relationship, or, you know, or a career, or a talent, or whatever it was. And then I would say, good, now how did that get there? And there's always a handful of people who would take credit for, you know, for meeting their wife or for their baby being awesome, you know. But then I would say, okay, great. All right, so you're responsible for that. If you want to take responsibility for that, that's great. Now, how did that get there? So if they said, well, I decided I was going to become a computer programmer, so I became a computer programmer, and I have this thriving career. Great. How did the desire to become a computer programmer get there? And it doesn't take very long to drill down to realize that the best things in your life were not put there by a conscious 10-point plan or 10-year plan. We might write them. I'm no expert on that. But it doesn't seem like the best things in our lives come from to-do lists. It seems like they come from moments like that in the hospital where there is no explanation for it. But ask me how many moments I've had as a performer that there's no way to describe how special it is, right? That was one of those moments. I could not have bought it. I could not have planned it. I couldn't have described it. I couldn't have written a story like that. And yet I walked out of there. I didn't even tell anybody. You know, I walked out of there and thinking,
wow.
Just wow. Just wow. You know, that I was able to do, like the last song says, I was able to make touch one person. What if one person is enough? What if I'll never sing in a stadium like Katy Perry or whoever it is? Is singing for that one lady and bringing back such a connection for her and such a memory and such feelings. I can't even, how can I even imagine the feelings she was having while I was singing? I'll never know. But to have done that for that one person, what if that's enough? What if I had died? No joke. What if my heart had stopped beating as I left that room? Would I have done enough? And the answer is, it's just going to have to be.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be up to me. It would just have to be enough. And that would be okay. And that's, you know, that's, it's an anti, it's not a very ambitious position to take in some sense, you know. But it's a real feeling. You know? So do I want to sing for a million? Yes. Do I want to sing in a stadium? Yes. Do I want to win a Grammy? Yes. But if I don't, will I have failed? I absolutely will not. I cannot condemn myself with that word, you know, with the scarlet F on my forehead. You know what I mean? If it doesn't achieve some earthly thing. I can't do it. Part of me wants to do it, but I can't do it. So.
Yeah, what does your watch say there?
That it is 5 minutes. It is 5:56 according to Apple.
And did you want to sing one last song before we close?
One more song?
Yes, your choice.
Okay. Well, we've talked around this subject, so let's do this one. One power invisible, and you see it everywhere and every day. One power indescribable, and you speak of it with every word you say. Mysterious until you know true, as simple as the love inside of you. Call it God, call it Spirit, call it Jesus, call it Lord, call it Buddha, Allah, angels' wings or heaven's door, but whatever name you give it, it's all one power, can't you see? It's the power of the love in you and me. One power. One power. One power. We speak so many languages. Different clothing, different colors, different names. But different is only dangerous when we forget that in the heart we're all the same. And we'll remember once we close our eyes to see that such distances were never meant to be. Call it God, call it Spirit, call it Jesus or Lord, call it Buddha, Baha'u'llah, Hashem or Heaven's Door. It's Muhammad, it's your mind, it's your soul, or it's your sign, it's the universe, it's music, Mother Earth, or Father Time, but whatever name you give it, it's all one power, can't you see? Whatever name you give it, it's the very air we breathe, it's the power of the love in you and me. One power, one power, one power is what we are. It's the moment of creation, it's an everlasting peace, it's the freedom of forgiveness, it's the sweetness of release. It's the joy of inspiration. It's the sunshine on your face. It's the birthright of all nations.
It's the boundlessness of space. It's the beauty of a baby. The serenity of sleep. It's the anger we abandon. For it's love that's most deep. It's one power. What we are is war. It's the power of the love that lives forever in you and me. It's the power of the love in you and me.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
We just got an okay to go as long as you have time. So, do you have time to?
I have a couple of minutes. I have to gonna get home and have dinner with my little boy, my wife.
Well, we can take one or two questions.
Absolutely. Let's ask.
So, if anybody would like to ask Daniel a question, raise your hand, and I'll turn the mic over to you. What's this? No hands? Okay, Lynn, releasing the mic to you.
Okay, I posted this on the board, but I looked you up on YouTube and was listening to some music and wanted to play some in the room. And so I picked this song, Grateful, and I loved it. It was great. And I downloaded a CD with a bunch of songs, and they're awesome. And I thought that was you. And I thought you were a hip-hop artist. But but I'm realizing now that it was you collaborating with someone. I don't know what made me pick that one. I have no idea. But when Ken was playing you this morning in the gathering, I was like, this doesn't sound like that same guy at all. So I just think it's very funny. But I found somebody else that I really like to listen to as well. So thank you. Anyway, I really enjoy your music. And thank you so much for being with us tonight. And Ken, I'll give you back the mic.
You're very welcome. That song, Grateful, that's Nemo, N-I-M-O, who's a friend of mine who lives in India. That's the friend I was mentioning who said that he knows the Water CD by heart because he was given the Water CD. He moved to Gandhi's ashram to live for a couple of years. I call him a kid because I'm 44 and he's 30-something.
Yes.
And he moved to Gandhi's ashram after building a successful career in the hip-hop industry in India, if you can believe it. And he's from the Bay Area and from India, both in his heart. And he lives in India and started an amazing nonprofit, essentially a little school, where he basically saved the lives of 16 kids who were living on the slums of India, enrolled the kids and their families in a program where they learned not just academic skills, but job skills, personal hygiene, and acts of kindness on a daily basis. I'm not making this up. He's that spectacular a guy. So when he moved to the Gandhi ashram, a friend of his handed him a CD and said, I think you'll like this. And he took it with him to the Gandhi ashram and had no interest in listening to music. He was trying to get out of the music world entirely and clear his head and see what he was called to do. And then he listened to this CD from what he called this obscure artist he'd never heard of, a CD he'd never heard of. And for the next 2 years, it's the only thing he listened to. He listened to the Water CD so much that when I finally met him and sang Planting Seeds with him, he knew it literally as well as I did. And we became friends. And while he was living in the Gandhi ashram, he he asked me if I wanted to write a song with him. So that Grateful song was produced in the room we're in right now, the studio here in Orange County, with him recording his vocals in Ahmedabad in India into a microphone. I can't picture. I don't know how he recorded his vocals. So we produced it and mixed it here. And then he has friends still in the entertainment industry, in India especially. And he solicited, his friends solicited footage of people singing that song all over the world. And my wife and I just watched a video last night of some school. I don't know. They might have been somewhere in Asia. We've gotten emails and contacts from all over the world. Kids especially listening to that song in school every day, and choirs singing the song. It's very incredible where the song has gone. So that's what you're watching. You're watching that video. That's Nemo in India. You see very brief shots of me. I'm the funniest looking guy in the whole video. All those beautiful little kids singing, and Nemo, handsome guy, you know, prowling the streets in India. And then me with my head, you know, with my headphones on in the little studio here, singing my heart out with that chorus. All that I am, all that I see, all that I've been and all that I'll ever be is a blessing. It's so amazing and I'm grateful for it all. Have you seen that video?
No. Oh. But I will now.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful, beautiful video. I had no idea when Nemo said, film some footage of yourself singing, we're going to put together a video. I had no idea what he meant. And my wife and I just sat there and just teared up. It's so lovely. It's surreal, you know. It's weird enough when I show up in a church, a Unity church or someplace, just happened a few weeks ago, flew to Florida, go to a church I've never been, start singing, and they know every word to every one of my songs. That's a strange enough experience. But to watch a video of little kids in a school in India singing a chorus I had written in my own studio a week before, that was a whole nother level of special. That was very weird and amazing. So the song is called Grateful. Just go to YouTube and look up Nemo, N-I-M-O, or my name, I think, but for sure Nemo, N-I-M-O, Grateful. Just those two words, Nemo, Grateful. Between the various websites, we, you know, 500,000, 250,000 people have watched it, which is just nothing in the grand scheme of, you know, YouTube video views. My son watches videos of people opening up chocolate eggs and eating them, you know, that have 50 million views. So it's not like it's taken the world by storm, nor do we care if it does. But has it done more than we even thought it would do or hoped it would do? Or, you know, it's just back to the water idea. Yeah, it was, you know, he's a grateful guy. I'm a grateful guy. So we were feeling grateful together, and that's what the song is.
Well, I guess that kind of goes with planting seeds.
Right.
If it's going to go viral, it's going to go viral.
Yeah, we just have, you know, nothing you can do about it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, it really doesn't matter. It, you know, again, just a drop of yes in an ocean. You know, that's all. We just put a little drop of yes in.
Yes.
Yeah. And you will love the video.
You will
love it. It's a beautiful video. I had nothing to do with it. It's just beautiful.
I will be sure to look at it. And Lynn has put a link in the board here to go watch it. So does anybody else have a question for Daniel before he gets back to his lovely wife and child?
Family, yeah.
If not, then we'll say goodnight. And thank
you, everybody, for listening. It's been fun.
And turn the mic back to you, Lynn, signing off.
Thank you so much, Daniel and Ken. That was beautiful sharing. I really did enjoy it. And I can't wait to watch that video. Thank you so much. And I'm going to turn the mic over to Lynn. So here you go, Lynn. What's next?
All right. Thank you, Lynn. And thank you, Daniel and Ken and everyone who's here for the satsang as well.